CBHDD is reminding people that the Georgia Crisis and Access Line can help those worried about opioid and stimulant misuse. The toll-free number is online and is active 24/7. More information at opioidresponse.info.
Thanks for listening to the Political Rewind podcast. Be sure to like and follow us and rate us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome to another edition of Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. Lots to talk about again today as early voting continues. We are moving toward the final day of voting, which is also called Election Day. Next Tuesday, we continue to set records with turnout, mostly on the Republican side. We all think because there are more hotly contested races there at the top of the ticket than on the Democratic side of the ballot. But we have a lot to talk about state elections, and we're going to take a look at what's happening in other states where primaries were held yesterday and have some relationship to what's going on here in Georgia. So let's get right to it. It's Wednesday. Greg Bluestein, political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, author of Flipped, and now an analyst, political analyst for NBC News on their various platforms. Greg Bluestein, how are you doing? This is an exciting time for political journalists.
It really is. 6 days left. I was on the campaign trail all day yesterday. Today is more of a writing day, and tomorrow I'll be back at it going to Southeast Georgia. And we expect a pretty big announcement in terms of the economic development world on Friday down in Savannah. So I'll be there for that as well.
Are we talking about an auto plant, Hyundai?
Perhaps an auto plant that has graced the AJC's front pages, so it's not like it's a secret, but it's 8,500 job development that is expected to be announced on Friday.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit about the power of incumbency just a minute from now, but let me introduce the rest of the panel before we do that. State Senator Kim Jackson, whose district is centered in Stone Mountain, is back with us. Democratic State Senator and an Episcopal priest whose ministry is in the homeless community, which we always like to point out, Kim, because it's frankly just such a wonderful way to serve in your community. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me, Bill. I'm glad to be here.
Sure. Edward Lindsay is with us. Edward is a former member of the State House, longtime member of the State House from Buckhead, City of Atlanta, and now is a partner and runs the Georgia Government Affairs section of Denton's, Edward, the world's largest law firm. I'm glad you're back. We haven't talked to you for a while. I'm really glad you're back.
Always delightful to be here.
Thanks. Thanks so much. And Claire Sanders is back with us, too. Claire is a senior lecturer in political science and public policy at Georgia College State University in Milledgeville. Claire, we were talking before the show about the fact it's getting hot all over the state, but you're down there in South Georgia where things really heat up.
Yes, we were talking about the recreation baseball games are really a lot hotter this week than they were last week. So we're spending all of our nights at the ball field these days.
You know, Lindsay and I, our children are grown and out of the house. We went through all that. But you and Greg Bluestein, you're still out there cheering your younger children on right now in baseball. And I think back to those days, and I wish I could say I envy you. But I'm glad you have them behind me. All right, let's get right down to serious business. Greg, we have talked on this show about the power of incumbency and how Brian Kemp has effectively used it in his campaign for reelection. I think it was Mel Brooks in The Producers who had a great line in which he said, "It's good to be the king." And in Brian Kemp's case, it is good to be the governor. Just this week, he announced a distribution of some $415 million in federal COVID relief money. It was initially set to go out at the beginning of the year, They held it back. It's now the week before the primary election, and there's a lot of money going out to a lot of organizations from the governor. Greg?
Yeah, as you said, more than $400 million. And look, I mean, to me, it's another example of how the governor is using every lever of power he possibly can. Yeah. And this goes back, and we talked about it on this show, to judicial appointments that are aimed at energizing conservatives, to, of course, the legislative session, to economic development deals. And now, we're heading to the closing days of this race. On Friday, he's set to announce the biggest economic development project in Georgia history. And on Monday, he's going to be campaigning with Donald Trump's vice president, Mike Pence, right? So these are all going for the jugular. He does not want any option, any sort of avenue for David Perdue to force a runoff. He's doing everything he can to get to that 50% plus one mark, because he knows better than anyone else what it's like to come in second place and go into the runoff with Donald Trump's endorsement, because he, of course, had that to his advantage back in 2018 during the runoff against Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle.
Kim, I want to talk in a minute about the fact that there are some really good organizations getting this money, and we should point that out. But we should also point out that it's only apparently at the very, very end of the news release, according to the articles I've read — I never saw the news release myself — that the governor's office mentions, oh, by the way, this is money from the federal government. And of course, we know that every Republican in the Georgia congressional delegation voted against distributing funds, COVID relief funds, when the bill came up for passage. So this is a largesse that Democrats were able to provide here in Georgia and other states across the country.
Yeah, that's right. We have to be really mindful of the fact that Republicans in Georgia especially tried to stop this money. And we also need to note that this money was supposed to be released in January. So our governor waited 4 months to release these funds that are really crucial and really important. You know, one of the organizations that this money goes to deals directly with people who are experiencing homelessness. It's trying to prevent people from going into homelessness. So this is 4 months of money that could have been gone, that could have gone out to help make sure that there weren't more people living on the streets, or to help get people off the streets. And the governor delayed that money in order to have this great big splash of Democratic money that we passed down to him. So we just need to be mindful of all of the different components of this, the ways that he's using money that Republicans didn't endorse to celebrate his campaign, and then the ways that he delayed it that actually hurts Georgians.
Edward, the governor's office would say they set up a process for deciding where the money went. They had a committee that looked at all of this. So, I mean, they have a rationale for why this comes when it does. Nevertheless, the timing is fortuitous at the least.
it is fortuitous. When you're the governor and a lot of good things are happening during your administration, but like the foreign election, of course, you're going to utilize the power of the incumbency. But the fact of the matter, there are a lot of things that are going. And getting back to Kim's point and also your point, is that the governor did, yes, this is money that came from the federal government. And there's, quite frankly, another huge package of money that's coming from the federal government as well, another $2.4 billion under the ARPA funds. The question is whether or not the governor is utilizing that money wisely. In Georgia's case, I think there's a good argument, quite frankly, that he has. He set up three separate committees. He didn't just rely upon his own staff, but he relied upon three separate committees to look at some critical areas of need in Georgia. And he's been very careful in terms of giving that money out to make sure it goes to places that are worthy. But, you know, I mean, the fact of the matter is he is in the closing days of the campaign hitting all cylinders with various constituencies in the Republican primary coming up. With the business community, he's obviously got economic development. With the social conservatives, he's signing some bills that the social conservatives are very excited about. And when it comes to moderates, more socially moderate Republicans in the suburbs, you know, his record over the last couple of years between signing hate crime bills and repealing citizens arrest bills has appealed to them. So he's doing everything he can to hit each that which is important to various constituencies in the Republican primary. while at the same time trying to avoid as much as he can discussing Donald Trump.
I apologize, Edward. Claire.
Oh, I would agree with what everybody's saying here. I think this is all about what we see in political science and politics in general, credit taking. So governors, especially incumbent governors, have a record to run on. This is all sort of the perfect storm, so to speak, of in terms of timing, in terms of, you know, planning to roll these announcements out right before the primary, as Edward was saying, speaks to the different parts of the electorate of his constituency that he wants to bring this message to. It's one thing when we're talking about opposing earmarks in principle, but it's another thing to try to explain to your constituents that, okay, we're not taking advantage of, you know, this assistance that's being offered to our state. So all politics is local, and I think that the timing of this and the power of incumbency being able to take credit for this relief is just sort of a sweet spot that the governor is seeing right now in his campaign that's coming to hopefully what he hopes is to a close next week.
Kim, I want to ask you about Democrats and the messaging around something like this and other issues in the news. For instance, the leaked opinion by Alito on abortion on Roe. There are some people that say, where are the Democrats? That's Gavin Newsom said that when the Alito leak happened. He said, where are Democrats fighting back on this? And for me on this show to point out that the money that Kemp is distributing comes from federal funds that were voted against by all Georgia Republicans in the congressional delegation. I mean, I'm not the guy who ought to be pointing that out. And I don't feel like Democrats are doing a particularly good job messaging on issues like this.
Yeah, I would actually challenge that, Bill. I think that Democrats have been coming out very strong to talk about the fact that Georgians, Georgia Republicans tried to vote against this money, but also to reiterate that we have failed to expand Medicaid, which is a federal money that's being offered to Georgia that we've left on the table millions and millions of dollars. I mean, Stacey Abrams has done a great job of highlighting the fact that, you know, Chris Christie came down and or is coming down to stump with Governor Kemp, Chris Christie, who expanded Medicaid, right? And so we are pushing these issues. I mean, man, we pivoted to talk about abortion to make sure that we really shored up the resources that are available today and to begin a fight to protect reproductive freedom in the future. So I just think you're wrong, Bill. Perhaps we may be in a little bit of an echo chamber, so maybe that's why you're not hearing us. But Democrats are rallied, have rallied together, and they are ready, and they are fighting and trying to spread the message of this is our time. And we are passing great, we're doing great work on the federal level, and we are demanding better work for us on the state level.
You know, Kim, thank you for saying all that, because I think you make a point that I'm mistaken to some extent. Certainly on expanding Medicaid, Democrats have been very strong. Stacey Abrams has been strong. The fact that Abrams is turning now her health care message toward choice for women is also very, very strong. So I think maybe you caught me out here. But I still feel, Greg, somehow that Republicans have always got a way to get their message across in perhaps it's more incendiary ways is what I'm thinking about.
Yeah, and look, I mean, it is also accurate to say that Democrats have struggled to have a counter message to the rising inflation of fuel prices, right? We've heard Democrats, some like Senator Warnock want to suspend federal fuel tax. You know, state lawmakers, Democrats and Republicans, suspended the state fuel state sales fuel, tax on fuel. But we haven't heard a sort of more cohesive message from Democrats overall about how to fight rising inflation and the economic uncertainty. You know, at least a unifying one that that is, you know, repeatable and that is out there, like Medicaid expansion. And I guess, you know, the other thing I'd say is that one of the challenges with Medicaid expansion, it's been the core message of Democrats since 2014 campaign, since Jason Carter, right? So it's not a new, it doesn't mean it's not a good message for Democrats, it's just not a new one. Because in 2014, Jason Carter ran on a platform of expanding Medicaid. In 2018, Stacey Abrams did as well. And in 2022, it's been one of the core issues of her campaign. This is something, though, that the the possible overturning of Roe v. Wade does give Democrats, we heard Stacey Abrams say it literally reshapes her campaign. We've heard Senator Warnock call himself a pro-choice pastor, and at the Democratic gala just a few nights ago made that a core part of his speech to Democrats. So it's something else that, that Democrats can rally around heading into November in a new way.
What you need to look at when it comes to what issues resonate most broadly is, you know, what are those issues that impacts everyone? And who can you lay responsibility toward if there's a problem at the foot of their door? And the fact of the matter is, inflation is impacting everybody across all ideological lines, across all economic lines, across all demographics. Every one of us is being impacted by inflation. And rightly or wrongly, and my friends on here who from the Democratic side will say wrongly, but rightly or wrongly, when you control the presidency and both chambers of Congress, responsibility for this extreme spike in inflation, which we have not seen since the early 1980s, is going to be laid at the feet of the party in power. But Bruce, I mean, numbers, I'm sorry, Greg raised a good point about the abortion issue, which has a direct impact, obviously, among, I think the last usual time, somewhere around 52% of the electorate. And so that's one of those broad-based issues that will also resonate. And we'll see how it cuts in terms of the pro-life versus the pro-choice movement in November. It's going to definitely play a role. The question is whether or not it plays as big a role as inflation and some of the other woes facing our country.
Claire?
And I would say, too, that I think both of the parties are trying to balance, you know, what messages they're sending right now. I mean, you're in a primary season, so I think the Democrats are really waiting for the Republican contest to play out, especially here in Georgia, to see, to really, you know, see what their messaging should be, because your general election strategy, I think if I was a Democratic strategist, I would be highlighting the issues like abortion and those issues to sort of get people to the polls to vote. But as Edward was saying, the economic issues, you know, the Democrats also have to be able to figure out, okay, short-term forces, are these more important than the long-term issues? And like you said, when economic issues are affecting people more broadly, supply chain issues are affecting people broadly, you know, with the formula issues, the baby formula issues that we're seeing right now. So I think both parties are having to figure out a way to balance these complex forces that we have now in terms of public policy.
I love it when people on the panel, like you, Claire, just now, talking about Democrats positioning themselves for a general election and the issues they'll take up then, rather than spend them all right now. And Kim, you're talking about how you feel Democrats have been aggressive on some big issues. Thank you. I always love it when I make statements that the panel is able to say, sorry, Bill, you got that a little wrong. So thank you for that. Hey, Greg, let's talk a little bit about the elections, particularly yesterday in Pennsylvania and North Carolina. And we should do that because, of course, Greg, we know there were some candidates strongly backed by Donald Trump in those races. And it's understandable if the people on the Republican ballot here in Georgia are looking over their shoulder at those races to wonder what Trump's power continues to be. Is he still strong? So with that in mind, we should say that Mehmet Oz, who he is endorsed for U.S. Senate, the Republican nomination in Pennsylvania, is in a very tight race today still with David McCormick. It's I think it's like a couple of thousand votes separating them. There are still many absentee votes that need to be counted out there. So it's hard to know what Trump's impact will be on that race quite yet. Right, Greg?
Yeah, and should we make a point that that in this case it's okay to count ballots after the election day?
That's
the Trump back candidate is more than happy to count ballots after election. No, and a reminder, that's just part of the process, and it'll be part of the process. There'll be some ballot counting in Georgia next week after, long after the polls close. But no, it looks like a split ticket, and then we've seen some of it. You know, a split decision for Trump. We see some victories. Trump backed Mastriano, the Republican gubernatorial candidate in Pennsylvania, who rolled to victory. There's a late endorsement for him. He backed Republican Senate candidate in North Carolina who rolled to victory. He had less luck in Idaho, for instance. You know, so there's some instances where Donald Trump's endorsement weighed heavily, and there's some instances where it didn't. And I imagine we're going to see a lot of the same in Georgia. I don't think that his ticket will sweep, and I don't think his ticket will get demolished either. I mean, Burt Jones is looking real good headed into it with an outside shot of winning an outright victory in the governor's race here, and he's the Trump-backed candidate. But David Perdue, as we've talked about, is lagging far behind Governor Kemp. Herschel Walker is the only candidate in Georgia, a Republican candidate, who probably didn't need anyone's endorsement to win because of his high name recognition. So that will go in the Trump column, but it didn't necessarily center on Trump at all. And then there's some races that I just, are going to be really hard to predict, like the 10th district race, where Vernon Jones, the former Democrat, is now backed by Trump. That could go into a runoff. That could go into a runoff without Vernon Jones, according to some polls I've seen. So we just don't know. But certainly all these races, and not just last night, but also previous primaries, we're all looking at them for indicators of how Trump's effect in Georgia will be. But Georgia is such a different dynamic from some of these states.
Yeah, I think that's really an important point. But let me throw this out, Claire. And you can take Pennsylvania as an example. Mehmet Oz could end up winning that race. He may lose it to McCormick. We don't know yet. But whether you had a Trump endorsement in that race or not, all of the candidates were Trumpy. Kathy Barnett, who seemed to be surging toward the end of the race but has now faded completely, may be Trumpier than Mehmet Oz himself. So you don't have to have the endorsement of Donald Trump. We're not going to know what the real impact of Donald Trump is on races, just whether his candidates win or lose. It's the Trumpy message that other candidates are sending out that's also important to look at here.
No, I was going to say that too, Bill. In terms of the Trump's endorsements, I think he had, 26 endorsements, and the majority of those seats that, or those candidates that Trump endorsed, I think were already pretty, the majority were pretty much safe. And so I think you're right in that maybe the Trump message, maybe the support for those policies, the candidate himself, are just sort of encapsulated in elements of the Republican Party.
The best line I've heard was from in terms of the impact of Trump and all of his endorsements around the country, comes from a Trump supporter in Savannah. It was published in the Savannah News, who was not supporting the Trump candidate. And what she said was, "He's not Jesus. I don't follow blindly anybody but Jesus." And that sums it up. Is Donald Trump a factor in these various races? Yes, he is. Is he enough to take someone to the victory circle? Well, it depends on a lot of other factors, a lot of other local factors. Two key things that I look at. One is how well known the candidates already are before Trump makes an endorsement. And number two is, what kind of attributes or baggage do they bring into a race? For instance, in the case of our race here in Georgia for governor, Brian Kemp and David Perdue are already very well-known figures. So while Trump may have a small impact on that, he's not going to have as great an impact as he is on some of these down-ballot races that Greg was alluding to. The second, and that also goes with someone like Herschel Walker. He's already a rock star among a lot of the electorate in Georgia, particularly among Republican electorate in Georgia. And I'm not sure whether or not Trump had any impact really in terms of his endorsement. Probably in terms of Georgia, so, you know, this is a Georgia program. The race I would look at most closely is the race in Idaho, where the incumbent governor, who had a strong conservative record among Republicans, was nevertheless not endorsed by Trump. Instead, the lieutenant governor was, and he won rather handily in that race. I think that that's something that, that a lot of folks should look at when it comes to what's the likely outcome here in Georgia. One last quick point, and I know you want to hear from the others as well. For Trump, it's not ideology in many situations. It's personal loyalty. You know, you spoke of several other candidates in the Pennsylvania race, you know, being more Trumpy than Dr. Oz. Well, the fact of the matter is Dr. Oz has shown greater personal fealty toward Trump than the other ones. And so for in many situations for Donald Trump, it's not so much ideology. It's personal loyalty. And that's what got Chip in trouble. Can anybody really seriously think that he's a rhino? No. But the fact of the matter is he didn't show total fealty to Donald Trump, and that's why Donald Trump is going after him.
Kim, last comments before we have to take a break.
Yeah, I think for me the question is, how is this going to play out in the general? So if people play strongly to the Trump kind of ideology, is the electorate going to go for that, right? Will Georgia Republicans rally around really Trumpy candidates? And I don't know. I think the question is still out on that. And so that's what I'm curious about. I'm very aware that as more people learn about who Herschel Walker is, particularly his past background around his lies about his businesses, around his relationships with women and the ways that he's been abusive, that people are having some more questions. And so I just look forward to seeing how this plays out in the general. The primary doesn't, for Democrats, the primary doesn't kind of matter right now.
Greg, I do want to say one more thing or ask you one more thing before we get to this break. For me, this isn't just about like a scorecard. Where does Trump win? Where does he lose? It's not just as reductive as that. It's about how long will the Trump grip remain the force in the Republican Party nationally? Because as long as he is the dominant force, the likelihood of our getting back to civil politics is virtually nil. So I think it's a bigger concern than just the scorecard. Yes, he won here. No, he didn't win there, right?
Yeah, Bill, and that's why the governor's race is so fascinating here, and that's why it's so closely watched, because you mentioned how in so many other races, candidates are just trying to out-Trump each other. The 10th district race in Georgia is a great example of that. The governor's race is not, right? Because Brian Kemp is not mentioning Donald Trump's name, only when asked, right? And he'll say, I'll never say a bad word about him or his administration. But he is not running to as a Trump Republican. He is not running on a MAGA brand. He is not praising the president, the former president, left and right. He's running on his own record. And that's what makes the Georgia governor's race so distinct from some of these other Trump-fueled contests around the nation.
All right, let's do this. Let's get to our first break of the show and come back with more on today's Political Rewind.
Thanks for listening to Political Rewind. If you like this show, you'll also like Georgia Today. It's a daily podcast from GPB News, bringing you compelling stories and in-depth reporting that you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Peter Biello, for this quick and convenient way to get the best of GPB News' extensive coverage of the topics that matter to you, delivered directly to your device every weekday afternoon.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Claire Sanders, Edward Lindsay, State Senator Kim Jackson, Greg Bluestein join me. A couple quick notes. Number one, I love how closely people listen to the show out there. We got a message from someone who said, Mel Brooks wrote the line, "It's good to be king," for the movie The History of the World, Part One, in the early 80s. Well, that's true, but he recycled it when he did the Broadway musical, The Producers, and he gave the line in that play himself. So we're both right on that one. The other quick note is that today's newsletter day at Political Rewind, Natalie Mendenhall and Sarah Callis have done a great job gathering good stories for you to be able to read in terms of what's happening in politics this week. And I added a blog From our conversation with David Gergen the other day, one of the saddest things I think Gergen writes about in a brand new book that we talked about on this show is he says, I think we can't find men and women of greatness in America today. And to me, that was very sad. And so he's talking about in the political arena. And so I suggest in the blog that I wrote for the newsletter, there are other areas we can look to where there are people of greatness. And I just point to one of them who I think is an example of that. You may have others. So read the newsletter. Subscribe to it at gpb.org/newsletters. And when you see the choice I've made, send me a note, tweet it to NigetB, or email me at bnigut@gpb.org. Give me your examples of who the real people are of greatness in this country today, whether they're in the political arena or not. Okay, Greg Bluestein, where the heck is David Perdue? He's not on TV, and he's making very few public appearances.
Yeah, we had a fun little item about that in the Jolt, in the morning newsletter at the AGC on Tuesday. And, you know, we were looking for him over the weekend. He had one quietish event down near the coast in Chatham County. But he was absent from digital media. He was absent from social media. He's off the airwaves. There's an outside group with a little money behind him, but he is not meaningfully pumping out TV ads or radio ads or digital ads. And his campaign has gone somewhat quiet shortly after we posted that he only had three events lined up for the week. His campaign added about four or five or six more. So now he has some more events, but most of them are kind of piggybacking off of existing Republican gatherings around the state. I think it speaks to just the challenges he's facing. And meanwhile, the governor, who's in pole position right now, he's scheduled something like 16 events. So he's putting his foot on the gas right now with a bunch of events, bunch of announcements. There's still official announcements such as the Hyundai deal that we talked about earlier that will probably be announced, is scheduled to be announced on Friday. And Perdue is not countering with his own forceful, aggressive response right now.
All right. Well, we're going to watch the governor's race in the days ahead, obviously. But I'd like to move on to another subject. Kim Jackson, I'd like to start with you on this one. President Biden went to Buffalo yesterday to offer his condolences to the families and friends of those who lost loved ones, the 10 people murdered in that horrific hate crime in the Buffalo supermarket. And he made a powerful statement about hate will not prevail. He called out white supremacy. He called out racism specifically. Give us your take on all of this. Let's talk about this just a little bit here.
Yeah, I was really grateful to hear the president be so clear and unequivocating about the importance of stamping out white supremacy in our nation. You know, this has been, as an African-American, watching the scenes from Buffalo and thinking about what it means to be targeted because of race still in 2022, is heartbreaking and really not, I think, even the America that my grandparents dreamed of for me. And so I'm really grateful for a president who's standing up and calling for us to make some changes. But I really am looking forward to and hoping to hear from some conservatives who will speak up and denounce behavior as well, who will stand up and denounce the ideologies that were behind this attack. You know, President Biden speaking is great, but what we need to hear is more white men who are conservatives, who may more better relate to the type of people who are attracted to these ideologies. We need to hear them stand up and speak out against it.
Edward, it feels like Republicans are having some trouble trying to figure out how to counter the Tucker Carlsons of Fox News and others who promote the replacement theory, this notion that Democrats are trying to bring non-citizens in, people of color, to become the dominant voters in the country, to give Democrats control of the reins of power. And we're not here, and we're hearing that now from people like Elise Stefanik in the U.S. House, Marjorie Taylor Greene as well. And other Republican leaders are not really calling them out.
Well, many of us are calling them out. Let me make sure that you do understand that, and to sort of echo what was said a moment ago by Kim, is that this is not an ideological issue. This is an issue of going after hate. From a personal standpoint, I remember the hubris of my graduating class, which, you know, I started off in a fully segregated school system in kindergarten and graduated in a fully integrated class from high school. And I do remember the hubris that we had across the racial lines. And we thought we were going to be the generation to put an end to this, that we were going to be the last generation that we had to look back upon our parents and say, okay, we love you, but you were wrong. And we're going to make a better world, and our children are going to enter into a better world. I think in many respects they have, our children have, but the incidents in Buffalo as well as the incidents in Pittsburgh and unfortunately numerous places around the country to mention tells us that we are still far short of that dream that Martin Luther King mentioned. And I think that the way to respond to that, whether it be any type of personality or politician that's espousing it, is to say no, that we have some differences in our society. We have some ideological differences on how to get to a better world, what's the best pathway. But when it comes to marginalizing people, taking away their full humanity in the way that this very sick young man did, and too many other sick people do as well, is we got to stand together. We got to sometimes listen to our priest, like him, who articulated it so well.
Claire?
Yes. I think the parties, we all have a responsibility. And yes, we have our policy differences, but we should all be united in condemning this tragedy. That's far too common. And I'm at a loss for words to even, you know, I don't want to even try to attempt to put it into words in terms of the grief and sorrow that that our nation, that community is feeling right now. But in terms of politics, I found it interesting that the president sort of put at the forefront this sort of conversation starter about where we are, and he brought up like replacement ideology, and then sort of another point, but sort of in the background, was sort of policy, you know, in terms of, okay, well, there may be some executive action taken in regards to things like gun control, but he even acknowledged that wasn't really going to be a reality in terms of any sort of major policy changes. So I found it interesting that the president's speech sort of presented this as sort of a national conversation to be had, rather than focusing on specific policies that need to be addressed.
Greg?
Yeah, and he had to do that because he knows he doesn't have the votes in Congress, you know, especially with the 60-vote threshold in the U.S. Senate. There has to be tremendous political will to change gun laws on a federal level to tackle some of these debates. But what we are hearing, and we're hearing it in Georgia as well, is we're hearing echoes of replacement theory. We're hearing echoes of, you know, they're coming to, you know, change our values. They're coming to and it's incumbent upon, as everyone here mentioned, it's incumbent upon lawmakers and figures from both parties to call that out when they see it.
Yeah, I think the other piece to note, I think that we see this in President Biden's comments, is that we are coming to recognize that this has to be a multi-pronged process to address. So gun control alone is not going to end mass shootings. Expanding access to mental health care alone will not end mass shootings. I mean, there's a whole multiple pieces that have to be addressed, including talking about the ways that replacement theory has infiltrated the Republican Party and must be rooted out, but also talking about the importance of really changing hearts and helping people to see that we are all a part of this United States of America. We are all welcome as a part of the fabric of our nation, and that's got to be kind of something that we embrace as a nation. But I think that's what we heard mostly in Biden's speech, though, is that there just isn't one simple policy solution that is going to end mass shootings. It has to be a multi-prong attack.
You know, if I may, Bill, real briefly, you know, replacement theory is the latest sick ideology that we've seen, but it's not new. I mean, we saw it obviously during the fight over slavery over 150 years ago. We saw it in the nativist attitude toward immigration during the height of the of immigration in the late 19th and early 20th century. We saw the exact same thing. And now we're seeing it again. This is one of these ogres that keeps cropping back up and raising its head anytime some people, for some reason, feel threatened and want to point the blame at somebody else, as wrongly as it may be. And it's something that we've all got to attack. And we've got to attack any individual that's proposing it. This is a sort of hatred that is, rots our nation at its core. And we simply all must continue to push back on it, and push back on any individual, whether it be a TV commentator or a politician or anyone else that wants to espouse it.
Greg, before we take our break, it does seem worth noting, as so many people have already, that the level of cynicism, commercial cynicism, at Fox News is extraordinary right now. Tucker Carlson is the single most popular personality on cable television, and he has, I think by one count, talked about the evil replacement theory something like 400 times in past months and up until today. And yet he's free to continue doing it as much as he wants to. I mean, at a certain point, How do we hold people like that accountable?
That's a great question. And, you know, there's been talks of corporate boycotts. You know, there's been talks of other sort of economic pushback. But, you know, we also are protected by free speech. So it's a very tricky dilemma. But when you have one of the most powerful networks on the planet, and one of the most powerful TV hosts on the planet, not only talking about replacement theory, but kind of sneering at anyone who points that out, right? The New York Times wrote this fantastic package of stories about Tucker Carlson, and his response is basically to stand in front of the paper, smiling and tweeting about it. I don't know. I mean, it's one of the media's biggest challenges right now.
Claire, he's become our day's Father Coughlin. Father Coughlin, the radio personality who preached very, very hateful, hostile messages, nativist messages in the late 30s, was an isolationist and had a great grip on many people in America because of his radio show. Carlson is the Coughlin of our day.
Well, again, I look at where we are in terms of the media, and I know Greg can speak to this better than I can in terms of mass communications. But I think in terms of our saturation, information, the internet, I know this sounds cliche, but I think we've lost, even though the internet's supposed to sort of open up information and open up access and be better for democracy, I think we've lost some of our accountability in terms of being in how we communicate with each other and how our civilized nature, our sort of human interactions, right? So I think it's just indicative of where we are in terms of just the lack of accountability that we have in some aspects of journalism and some aspects of the internet and some aspects of just our communications in general.
Yeah, I just want to say that this shooting, let's have it. It took place about from an 18-year-old. This was an 18-year-old who ostensibly was educated in local schools. And this is one of the reasons why I think so many people were very adamant about the importance of not changing our curriculum when it comes to telling the truth about our history and our past as it relates to race. One of the most important, I think, fundamental key pieces of why knowing our history is helpful is it helps us to not repeat the sins of the past. And so, you know, there was a lot of people couldn't understand why we fought so hard against, you know, bans against critical race theory, which of course it wasn't critical race, but why we fought so hard against the divisive concept bill. It was because we know that if we don't teach young people about the sins of a past, if we don't teach young people about the segregationist theologies and ideologies that we've had as a nation, that we are bound to repeat them. And so I just want to name that, that that is a part of one of the issues that we've got to wrestle with, is we've got to make sure that we are providing a holistic education in history to our teachers and to our children in our schools.
Kim Jackson gets final word, and appreciate those words, Kim. Before we take our final break of the show, we'll be back to wrap things up in just a minute. Greg Bluestein, this is the last time we'll be talking to you on Political Rewind until the day after the primary election, which takes place finally next Tuesday. And by the way, I want to start talking about this now. Next Wednesday, you all know out there that we do our show live at 9 in the morning and then repeat it at 2 in the afternoon. Next Wednesday, we'll be doing it live both times because results may be coming in throughout the day on Wednesday, and we want to make sure we're on top of what's happening. But, Greg, what I started to ask you is, so what are you going to watch most closely, do you imagine, in the days ahead? What are the stories that are of most interest to you right now?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be at Brian Kemp's watch party. He's the story runoff or route, you know, whatever the story, whatever happens in that race, I think is the local story, the national story. You know, we'll also be closely monitoring the Herschel Walker's fate, you know, if it's a closer than expected victory or if it's a route as well in that one, or if, you know, there's a surprise and he's forced into a runoff. But really, you know, I'm really fascinated by the Secretary of State's race and some of these other down ticket races on the Republican and Democratic side. On the Democratic side, there's so many unknowns. There's such high levels of uncertainty of undecided voters on these very important races like Lieutenant Governor and Secretary of State and labor commissioner, you name it. And the Republican side, there's a little bit more solid polling because there's just a lot more money involved in those races. And I'll be looking to see, for instance, if Burt Jones can land a knockout blow and win lieutenant governor's race on the Republican side outright. And also these congressional campaigns. Will Vernon Jones' Trump-backed campaign, will he make it into a runoff? You know, some of these other contests are going to be really, really interesting.
I want to give each of you at least a moment on that. Claire, pick a race or two that you think you're going to be most interested in watching.
Well, I'm definitely interested in the governor's race and the Secretary of State race, just in terms on the Republican side, just because I'm even more interested in what the status of the Republican Party will be in terms of unity after this primary. And so I'm looking for things like, will Governor Kemp be the unifying force of the Republican Party, which is a really interesting question. If you had asked that a few months ago, you know, right after the 2020 election, he was very divisive. So I'm really interested to see what the future of the Republican Party is in terms of party unity.
Kim, the Democrats have not gotten as much attention because of all the races that are on the Republican side, the top races that are so competitive. So what are you looking to see for the Democrats coming out of primary night?
Yeah, so I'll be watching the Carolyn Bordeaux-Lucy Bass race to see what the outcome of that is. It's a very interesting fight here to see kind of how that falls out. And then our lieutenant governor's ticket is packed. I think there are 9 different candidates. And so to see kind of how that plays out and if it's going to be, you know, Burt Jones or Butch Miller on the Republican side, or if it's going to be one of the 9 on the Democratic side, I'm excited to see who is going to be on the top of the ticket with Stacey Abrams in that race.
Thank you. And Edward, you get the final word as we run out of time.
Yeah, the lieutenant governor's race is going to be interesting, as Greg alluded to it. Secretary of State's race is going to be extremely interesting because if there's one individual that has had the full wrath of Donald Trump, it's Brad Raffensperger. If he makes it into a runoff, that in of itself will be a victory for him. On the Republican side, 2 congressional races will also be interesting. One will be the 10th. And the other one will be the 6th. Who makes the runoff in both of these races? In the 10th in particular, you know, we talked about the impact of Donald Trump. If Vernon Jones gets it in the runoff, that shows his impact. The 6th is also going to be very interesting to see whether or not Trump's appointee.
Edward Lindsay, always a pleasure to have you here with us. Claire Sanders, thank you so much. We look forward to having you come back and Senator Kim Jackson as well. Your voice is always, always a powerful one on this show. Greg Bluestein, thank you, of course, for being our Wednesday partner on Political Rewind. I look forward to talking to you next week when we'll have a pretty good sense of how all of these races have played out. That's it for us today. We're back with a new show tomorrow. Mark Nisi from the AJC will be here. He's done a great job keeping on top of the election as it's unfolded. He's going to talk about that with us and much more. In the meantime, I'm Bill Nygut. Please take care. Stay healthy. See you tomorrow.